accession number 13935, reel 2.
I just managed to climb back in and collapse exhausted. I knew I had made a terrible mistake, one which had nearly cost me my life, and weakened me so much that it might yet do so. My only chance of being saved was to stick to the dinghy, however close I must come to land again. During the afternoon, the wind sprang up and the sea became rougher. The awful exertions of the previous 18 hours had taken their toll, so that I sat quite comatose with eyes half closed, lulled by the waves smacking and rocking the dinghy, but still believing it would be only a matter of time before I was rescued. The upper half of my body had partially dried out, and although I was still sitting in 2 or 3 inches of slops, half sea water, half urine, in the bottom of the dinghy, the discomfort was tolerable, and I allowed myself to drift away from the reality of the situation. In this complacent mood, I was aware that the waves were slapping harder and harder against the side of the dinghy, but it was not until the first clap of thunder in the distance that I snapped back to my full senses. I opened my eyes wide, and the scene had changed with unbelievable rapidity. The isolated pinnacles of white cumulus cloud had turned as if by some Machiavellian wand into a solid, towering black cliff of cloud bearing down on me, and only broken by shafts of lightning. The sea was now a mass of individual waves, as a storm built up the wind and water before it. I had only time to check my Mae West for inflation and secure a few items in the recess of my battle dress before the violent behaviour of the dinghy began to require my full attention. It was not long before the waves were 10 to 15 high, with white crests whipped by the howling wind into a white frenzy of foam. The dinghy lurched in an ungainly manner to the top of each wave, where it spun crazily in the boiling caps before dropping sickeningly, half waterlogged of the deep trough behind. I was now leaning on all my reserves, bailing the dinghy out and facing it into each new wave, using the scoop as a paddle, in the knowledge that if the dinghy broached sideways, the beaks of the wave would capsize it. I was drenched in water, and the battle became a personal one with the storm itself. I was holding my own until from the top of one wave I saw a monster, towering and boiling above the rest, blotting out the horizon, bearing down with the noise and velocity of an express train. I was suddenly looking up at a wall of water with a cruel white beak curving over it. Christ, I thought, this is it. The dinghy rose protesting until it was almost vertical, and the beak snapped it over and over. I remember grimly hanging onto the side while the dinghy rotated round me in the whirlpool of green and white water. Then it plunged downwards into the trough behind. I only just managed to climb back on it before the next wave overtook me, but this time the dinghy behaved in a much more stable way, and I realized that the water flooding it was now acting as ballast and keel. Darkness and the full force of the storm coincided when the sea enjoined into one orchestra of wind, water, and drums of thunder, whose stage was illuminated by vivid shafts of lightning. And so the night became the battleground, each wave a charge to repel, each trough a breathing space to regroup and face the next one. I lost all count of the number of times a dinghy capsized that night, only realizing the urgent necessity of writing it and scrambling back inside, with the knowledge that the storm had gained more ground as the effort sapped my strength. The full holocaust of the storm lasted three or four hours, but even then it did not give up, returning again and again to snap and growl. The lifting of the curtain of dawn did not diminish the storm's anger. I was terribly aware of my exhaustion and the awful state of my body encrusted with salt. The noise of the wind and water continued as the sea came sweeping in, big Atlantic rollers, not just with white caps, but strong surging surf. The thunder and lightning had died away with the coming of the dawn, but the rain was now so blinding I could hardly tell sky and sea apart. There was not a sound of anything human, just the howl of the gale and the roar of the sea. I continued to capsize, always just managing to find the will to climb back in the dinghy again. And all day I continued to fight, because I knew that to give in was to accept death, and I was not prepared for that yet. I experienced many emotions, anger, terrible loneliness, and finally fear. It is not so difficult to face death in the heat of battle, surrounded by one's comrades, but all alone, losing ground bit by bit, until it becomes blindingly clear that you are going to ground, fear becomes overpowering. Of course I prayed. I promised God anything if he'd only get me out of the sea. Slowly and inexorably, I was worn down, so that when the next night came, much of the fight had gone out of me, and in the last rounds, I was just holding on. The wind and sea had dropped a bit during the night, and I no longer capsized, but just rocked and tossed until another dawn broke. With the slow abatement of the storm, and in the early morning, I took stock of my physical condition. My lips were cracked and so swollen, my eyes merely slits, my hands puffy and white, and my legs felt like lead. Everything was caked and matted in salt, and the will to live had gone. Indeed, if I had capsized, there was no energy left to return to the dinghy. I gradually became conscious of a quite new situation. The pain and the cold had disappeared, and only a rather pleasant numbness remained. The scene had slowly begun to change, and the monotonous grey of the sky and sea had given way to bright, diffused colours, and I began to pick out a countryside of fields, houses, and trees. I could even make out a canal with some laughing people beside it. I no longer had a body and could move quite freely outside of it, so that I was able to look down at someone else lying in the drifting dinghy, without realizing or bothering about it. My vision became quite clear, and the countryside real, and it was about this time that three people appeared. They came together, Ewan Charters in an army uniform, Trevor Wood in his Air Force uniform, which I thought peculiar because he had been killed in operation 6 months earlier, and finally Bambi, more fawn-like than ever. They stayed and talked with me. I cannot remember exactly what they said, but they were all together, and there was no need to worry or struggle any further. The air seemed full of new noises, like the countryside on a hot summer's day, and I felt myself drawn more and more into it. Time meant nothing, and a most incredible and wonderful peace came over me. I was not conscious of anything until I felt hands grasp me roughly. I resented this and told them to go away. I heard voices, this time strange and harsh. Lift him up gently. Is he dead? What a mess. I felt searing hot liquid poured into my mouth, which I immediately spat out. I thought, this is a funny death. Then oblivion came. But more hands grasped me. A blur of faces looking down from a quayside. I thought, why can't I be left alone in peace? Now strong hands exploring my body. A sharp prick and then oblivion. I felt a terrible pain. I moved a hand. I knew it moved because I touched my bare thigh. I opened an eye with difficulty. It was absolutely black, and I could hear the roar of the sea again as it tumbled over me, and all the pain and cold returned. I shouted in horror, and then a blinding light, a light bulb, and a vague outline of a woman's face in a white cap, another prick and oblivion. I opened my eyes again. Pain was all around, all over me. It was light, and I could make out a room. I was in a bed. A man said, what's your name, old man? Flight Lieutenant Horsley. My voice sounded funny, miles away. Where do you come from? That was funny, too. Where did I come from? I had to think quite hard. Thorny Island, I said, and I went to sleep again. After a while, I remember a voice saying, yes, that's Horsley, all right. I'll ring his wife straight away. I began to realize I was alive. I looked round, and I was in a room, the sole occupant, with a number of beds, of other beds, all neatly made up. It reminded me of something. Oh, yes, a sick quarters. I moved around in bed, a bit painful, but everything worked. I wondered if I could stand up. I eased back the bedclothes and edged out of bed. I straightened up and fell flat on the floor. The door opened and a voice said, what on earth are you doing? Get back into bed immediately. A young nurse helped me back into bed and said, I'll get the doctor. A young man in naval uniform came in. Well, you're looking chirpy. How do you feel? Bloody, I said. Where am I? You're in the naval sick bay at Seaview in the Isle of Wight. An air sea rescue boat brought you straight into harbour here. We stuffed you full of sedatives and pumped half the channel out of you, and you're lucky to be alive. Daddy Dale, the CO of 21 Squadron, came over from Thorny Island with one or two of the boys, bringing some clothes and toilet stuff with them. Also, when they had the time, two captains of the air sea rescue boats visited me, Keith Beacon and Flight Lieutenant Newman. From them all, I pieced together what had happened. Early on the morning after I was shot down, Daddy Dale had assembled a squadron to go and look for me. But the weather was so bad, Group would not give him permission for them to take off. However, the two Esky rescue Spitfires, had been dispatched, but were never heard of again. They had found me all right, but I'd obviously remained so low under the cloud base that any radio transmission had failed to be picked up. So they had either flown into the sea themselves in the bad visibility or had been shot down. The area I was in was a hunting ground for German E-boats and dangerous for air sea rescue boats. Nevertheless, two boats, HLS 198 with Keith Beacon, and HSL 192 with Flight Lieutenant Newman, came out to look for me, but were ordered to return to base because of gale conditions, which continued throughout the night and next day. They came out again on the third day as the gale abated and found me. Although I wrote about the storm immediately afterwards, Keith Beacon, in peacetime a cow's sailing photographer extraordinary, wrote about the event many years later in his book, The Beacon File. The following extract describes it from a different but very caring angle. One day the Nap Tower flashed us a message, proceed to position 55 miles, 185 degrees NAB. Setting course on our grinned compass with the electric log at zero, compensating for the westerly tide at 1.5 knots, we adjusted our speed to 27 knots and set off in company with another RAF launch. Arriving at the estimated position, both boats then started the usual square search, going in opposite direction. The weather was very rough and getting worse. After 4 hours of searching as daylight vanished, we suddenly had a radio message, returned to base because of gale conditions. We were naturally furious, for while it was no weather for us to be out in, it was considerably worse for the dinghy we were searching for. The next day we were weather-bound in harbour and had to content ourselves with working out the estimated position that we thought the dinghy must have arrived at with the east and west tides and a westerly gale. Next day the gale was abating, so HSL 192 and my 198 set off again to the new estimated position of the dinghy that we had plotted on our charts. After 4 hours, we spotted the dinghy. He was a Mosquito pilot, and his navigator had been lost. While he was being pulled up on the scrambling net, we kept an eye out on the enemy coast at Cherbourg, which was about 8 miles away, and also keeping a lookout for enemy fighters. 3 shells landed, one to port, one to starboard, and one astern. Nice grouping. We made up fast on a zigzag course, endeavouring to make smoke to cover our exit. The pilot was taken to Seaview and placed in the naval sick bay, where he gently covered from 3 days in gale-force conditions in a rubber dinghy. The RAF learned many things from this pilot: how to survive at sea, good and bad points about rubber dinghies, and so on. There is an interesting sequel to this rescue. About 15 years later, HRH Prince Philip was paying a visit to the Eiling Sailing Club at Cowes, together with his equerry, Wing Commander Peter Horsley. Meeting in the club, Wing Commander Horsley noticed that I was wearing an SE rescue tie, and he, by chance, was wearing a goldfish tie, a tie only available to pilots who had ditched in the sea in wartime and lived to tell this tale. After a few minutes, he realized the pilot we had picked up with HSL 182 off Cherbourg. And what a reunion then took place. I have since written to Sir Peter Horsley as is now, and here is his side of the story. The details of my struggle with Father Neptune are still vivid. I remember this incident as a very personal encounter, where I was to survive against a sea which was equally determined to engulf me. I made many mistakes which nearly cost me my life. But basically it was luck, physical fitness, my RAF training, which contributed most to my survival. The worst mistake I made was at one stage to desert the dinghy, which I seemed incapable of steering, and try and swim to the shore about 10 miles distance. Fortunately, after 50 meters or so, I came to my senses, and just found enough strength to return. But it snapped all my energies badly. There were many poor design features in the dinghy, apart from its size, which was excruciatingly small, the worst thing being these which with it turned turtle. Since the sea was rough, it did this many times, which was then followed by the inevitable struggle to right it and get into it again. These sequences were more than anything which took their toll and led me to my ultimate surrender on the third day. There was one funny part. I decided to help keep my health going, and I should perform my usual toilets in the dinghy, which came too foul to put up with. So I tried to remedy this by putting my bottom over the side of the dinghy, which resulted in my doing a backward flip into the water with my trousers round my ankle. I only wish it could have been filmed, as it was worthy of the best Charlie Chaplin antics. There were also some strange aspects to the experience, which I believe are not unknown in the moments of extreme mental and physical stress. For example, I seemed to float away from my body and clearly remember looking down on myself in the sea. Towards the end, I began to drift away into another world of incredible peacefulness, made up of scenes and people. And all the time I knew I had to fight my back to reality and the sea. On the third day, I did give myself up to this peacefulness and remember little else. Flight Lieutenant Newman on HLS 192 did say I was out of my dinghy with my May West on. I was not particularly a religious person, but I felt in such an isolated position when final drowning appeared inevitable that there were other forces at work. The whole episode left me with a very philosophical view of life, in that while other people tend to take life problems and setbacks seriously, I'd viewed them less so, in the knowledge that the important thing is life itself. Therefore, I had become inclined to live each day for itself. Keith Beacon continued, if the reader has formed the impression that these rescues were cold and factual, of course they were not. To be separated from the sea by a piece of thin rubber dinghy, even for 4 hours in the English Channel, hoping that is found, is bound to make a man's thoughts chaotic. Our task was to save people from possible drowning, knowing that each minute was vital. At the first sight of a dinghy, that a live occupant, one thanked God for his eyesight and determination to beat the sea at its end game. One sight, however, remains in my memory, that of a young, he looked 17, navigator, in Air Force blue uniform, curled up in a tiny dinghy, as if he was just about to be born into the world. We thought he might be asleep, but he had passed into the next world. His mother will know that he was lifted tenderly out of his little cocoon and returned to his squadron to be given a burial by his brother aircrew.
Who actually was Bambi?
Bambi Gunn was my navigator.
What was his name, though?
Bambi Gunn. G-U-N. G-U-N-N.
And Bambi was just a nickname?
Nickname, yeah. His first name was Frank.
How old was he in actual fact?
I suppose he... when he was killed, about 18 or 19.
And had you been hit by flak or by an enemy?
By an enemy night fighter.
Had you
coming behind me. Oh, no, it was a dark night.
So how did you know it was a night fighter rather than the flak?
You know, yeah. You could almost feel the bullets hitting the engine. It was a night fighter, all right. A flak is something which explodes under you and comes up. This was horizontal fire. Remember, in a mosquito, the pilot can't see behind him. The navigator, my navigator, his head was in the G-box, so we were blind behind. He came up our tail and shot both engines away. I mean, with flak, you wouldn't get both engines. You get one. It was a dead astern shot.
What was it like flying a mosquito in wartime?
Oh, it was a fine aeroplane. It was a Spitfire with two Merlins. It was very fast. You could get away from a single engine aircraft by diving it. You couldn't stay and mix it with a single engine fighter because a single engine fighter was far more maneuverable than a twin. Also, I think with flak intended being it being a wooden construction aircraft, flak intended to go straight through it, as opposed to the metal aircraft bursting inside. Oh, it was a very good aeroplane indeed. Marvellous.
How long do you think in hours you were in the sea?
I was shot down on about 11:30 on the Saturday night. So Saturday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday. I was picked up about 5 o'clock on a Tuesday. It was terribly rough. It was the roughest gale they'd had since about 100 years. So rough that the air sea rescue boats were ordered back into port. It really was a very rough sea indeed. Very rough.
Did you have any long-term physical effects?
Oh, yeah. I was back in flying within 6 months. But it was fairly hard flying. I mean, flying over the sea again, you had to grit your teeth and take a grip of the control column to do it. There were a lot. I think I burst some fuses.
How do you mean?
Both mentally, and certainly mentally. I think any shock, it's like being shell-shocked. Nothing was ever the same again.
But the physical effects were medium rather than long-term.
I would think it took about 10 years to get over it altogether, to become quite normal again.